so happy to have Monica McIntyre here and Jannie Dix. They run, they're co-founders of an amazing organization, Aftercare International. And I truly believe that your guys' message needs to be heard by everybody. And hopefully this can play a small role in getting that message out there, because I think it's so powerful and important. We're going to get into Aftercare International and exactly what you guys are doing right now, but I want to hear your before. So where were you at before this? What was kind of the start of what you guys were doing? What got you involved in this cause?
For me, it started the day I discovered human trafficking was a thing. I thought it was a Hollywood production, actually. I was pregnant with my fourth child, and I watched this documentary called Human Trafficking. It was a four-hour movie, I remember. And I saw, after I finished watching it, I was frozen. I was like, I asked my husband, is this real or is this Hollywood? And he said, no, this is real. This is real, yes. And so I went to sleep that night. I think it was like 48 hours, to be honest, that it took me. And I said, I can't live. I woke up, I was having breakfast with him, and I said, I don't think I can live a life without doing something about this. I have three, and I'm going to have four very soon. Perfect children, blessed with everything. And I can't imagine what a mother would feel if they didn't have their child next to them and this was happening to them. I can't live in this world and not do something about it. So I had a business at that point in time. It was doing pretty good. I closed it. And I decided I was going to go back to school and study so that I could help children who are surviving this. And so I did. That's my previous world was what I always call my first life was in the corporate world, you know, working with Honeywell, with American Express, etc. And then just folded everything and went back to school so that I could get into this. That was how I got into this. How did you get into this?
I remember very similar, like the first time that I had heard about it. I had worked at a rape crisis and domestic violence shelter, and I ended up having to leave because my oldest daughter had some health complications. And one of the women that eventually took over for my position had told me about human trafficking, and I thought very similar. I thought there's no way that this is real. And watched a documentary, and I had the same effect. Like, is this really real? Like, or is this someone's reality? And I remember asking her to send me more things. And then it started to hit me some of the scenarios and situations that I had seen when I worked at the rape crisis and domestic violence shelter. It hit me like, oh my gosh, those were trafficking situations. And very similar, it was like almost I felt like I have to do something. And at the time, I was a really young mom. I can't remember if I think I might have had my twins at that point. So I had my older daughter and a set of twins. And I ended up going into signing up for a conference that was in this little city that I grew up in, that I work or I lived at. I ended up going to this conference, and I remember sitting on the curb calling my mom and being like, I cannot believe that this is real, like, and just all that I had learned. And so eventually I had thought I have to work in this space somehow. I have to help in this space. And I was pregnant with my fourth daughter when I was hired to work for an organization that was in this space, and the rest is history. So,
okay, so you both kind of similar stories. You heard about this problem and you were immediately like, I need to do something, and shifted pretty much your whole lives to work on this thing. What did that look like? Like, when you went to school, Monica, you started studying about this. What did it look like? How did you start implementing that? Kind of like, what was the start of your journey actually getting involved?
So I went back to school, and there was internships and started volunteering in places that could help me, because I wasn't in the field. I needed to gather experience as much as possible and as varied as possible so that I could actually be of some use. I worked at Children's Advocacy Center. We're working with 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, all sexually abused. Decided to work for the Colorado Crisis Line so that I could focus and have some sort of a deep understanding on suicide and all the symptoms that are associated with survivors. You know, there's many of them, but focusing on the three main ones, you know, suicide, sexual abuse, and addiction. Those were the three, and they were all on my checklist. So very slowly, like an ant, up a hill, checking each box so that it could allow me to. So through experience, obtaining experience, and we were talking earlier, I have four kids, so it was like, I don't know how I had the time. I remember sometimes doing supervised visitations for kids on a Sunday at 5, because that was the only time I could. Leaving them with my husband for a couple of hours, you know. However, it was almost like magic trying to put the pieces that I could slowly advance in it and obtain and get the qualifications, the minimum qualifications that I thought were necessary to be able to help appropriately in the field.
Yeah. And what about you, Jenny? So you were working at the crisis center.
Yeah.
And you said you joined an organization. What organization is that? How did that start?
Yeah, so, well, I first heard about Operation Underground Railroad at its very beginning stages. And I, like most people, felt really compelled to the cause, right? And so I was like, I'm going to work there someday. Or, and at that point, I had worked at other organizations, other nonprofits, but never really in the anti-trafficking space specifically. But eventually I started volunteering there. Through miracles, I ended up volunteering there. And then they asked me if I'd like to work there. And the day they asked me I wanted to work there, I had delivered my fourth baby. And I did not tell them that I just had a baby. So I remember coming downstairs after having my baby and sitting on the couch and telling my husband I just got a job, and he thought I was nuts because he thought I was just on pain pills and like that I was making stuff up. But anyway, so like I said, I ended up working there for 7 years until their mission and my mission kind of shifted and my views and their views shifted. And partly being there caused me, kind of like Monica, to realize like I need to be better prepared myself. And so I had experience organizing people and running volunteer organizations. And so that was my main purpose at OUR, was running their outreach program and finding ways for good people to get involved. And I had experience in that, but I also saw some holes in not only myself, but in the organization. And so that compelled me to go back to school. So I ended up currently in school now, but did a double master's in public administration and social work. And the reason I ended up doing that is because you have situations where you have people with all the heart in the world that want to start something, but they don't understand maybe how to run a business or a nonprofit. But then you also have situations where people know how to run a business, a nonprofit, but they don't understand the clinical aspect of what you're doing, right? And who how to help your target population. And I felt it was pretty crucial and important for me to understand both of those scenarios and situations. And so kind of like Monica, I'm slowly inching my way through gaining knowledge and experience that will, you know, propel me to continue to better serve those that we get to serve.
Yeah. Well, I think if we went through the list of things, the experiences as well as licenses and all the other accreditations, I think most people would think that you guys are more overqualified for what you're doing. And I think that's what is so amazing about what you guys are doing is you truly not only have the heart there, like you said, but also the know-how and the knowledge to do it the right way. So with that being said, like what are you guys doing? What's Aftercare International? How did you guys come together? Do you want to take it away?
Yeah, let's see. So I'll take us back slightly to how we met. So I was volunteering in that space as I was studying, and I was looking online and I found Operation Underground Railroad, and there was a volunteering for, I can't even remember exactly what it was for, but it was something like a volunteering. Regional volunteer coordinator, and I'm like, I'm doing it. I don't know what that is, but I'm doing it. I'm 100%. So I applied, and Jenny called, and I thought, wow, she's really cool. This is what it's like. I love this already. And she said, yes, okay, we'll start. And just like she described right now with her coming down after her birth, I was like, my husband got home and I'm like, I was so excited. He thought I'd gotten a job. I told him it was a volunteer. It was unpaid. But he was really happy because he knows how passionate I am. And so that's how it started. We started with, that's how, where we met. And I was there volunteering for a very long time, then ended up in the, Jani proposed me for the Board of Governors. So ended up doing that for a year. And what was the question, Sydney?
Well, kind of how Aftercare International started, but let's,
okay.
With that, with where you're going, what were some of the things that you noticed being involved in OUR and working closely with them? Like, what sparked you to be like, hey, I need to start something on my own?
Okay, great question. So I had been always interested on the aftercare part of it. How do you deliver those services? You know, how are they, like Jani said before, I had my MBA, so I had the business part of it. And my questioning was like, are these places sustainable? Are they doing things appropriately? I didn't use the right terminology at that point. You know, are they clinically viable? Is it evidence-based? Is it, you know, all the things that now I can think of. But it was like, are we sure that these places are good for them? Are we doing the best we can for them, you know, in these places? And who's managing that? And I kept on sending emails. I even remember sending a proposal, an offering to, with a whole business plan to do it in Latin America.
And I was pushing it too on my end because I had known of her experience and qualification.
And the suggestion on how to do it in Latin America was like my playground. So it was like, okay, you know, this is something, maybe a way to start, but there was no response.
And did you feel that on your end as well, Jani? Like you were trying to push it through as well and just no real response?
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like a closed door, yeah, that area. And I think a lot of it now that I think a lot of it was due to the fact that there wasn't a door almost.
Yeah, but so there wasn't a person there.
They didn't really want to touch it because I don't think they really knew what was going on either.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I want to say, and I don't know, I don't think it was out of malice. It was just out of not knowing how to answer or what was being really asked. Or
nervous of,
yeah,
somebody coming in that may know.
That may ask questions. Yeah. I don't know. So they didn't let me. And I think after the second year, I was already in the Board of Governors. And I thought, this is not okay. I mean, if somebody cannot speak to what they're doing with transparency, I'm uncomfortable. It's not okay. So I thought, no, this needs to be done better. You know, actually, this is bigger. I mean, because it's an area in itself. It should be something that should be a coordinated effort with all those good souls in the world that are trying to help these people, you know. And it's an industry. This is not my words. This is research. It's an industry that's highly fragmented. And everybody comes in with a good heart. And like Jani said, we've spoken about this many times, is like, but they might not have the business avenues to do it. Or somebody has a business avenues, but of both. So it requires certain nuance for it to operate well, but more importantly, to operate sustainably over time. Because this, you know, survivors need, not only they deserve the best care, it's something that is long-term. It's not a short-term solution. It's not, you know, I went 30 days to a rehab for addiction, and it's a lifelong situation. So it was like talking and putting plans. And I used to do tourism before, so there was this constant thing of how do you create a network international about it exists. You know, back then, and I'm dating my time. You know, they called them. It was when you wanted to fly, there were three main databases that had all of this conglomerated. And I was like, we should have one where we should have a space where they can all talk to each other, where they can all help each other, where they can all learn from each other. You know,
and what, who's they?
Let all these aftercare homes, yeah, you know, is like, okay, the ones that are operating in Brazil might have something that is totally unique that would apply beautifully in Thailand, maybe not in Scotland, but somewhere else. So it was like, have this community, and we thought, hey, we have to create something where not only there's collegiality for them to work together, but where they have access to things that exist. Here in the U.S., we're very blessed, right? There's research. We have access to a million things. this is here in the developed countries. That's the easiest part to do it. Why not make that accessible to those who don't have it? And for those who are in the developed countries, learn from those that are not developed, because there's a lot of learning both ways, you know? And so when we decided to open, when I decided to leave, and there was a couple other people that left the board, actually it was closed after that. I don't know if they ever reopened it, but that's irrelevant. When we decided to leave, we said, okay, why don't we create that platform? Why don't we create that platform where all these entities worldwide that are trying to support this space can be together and can access, have a toolbox of things to help them do the job that they're trying to do.
So also with one of the things that's really important in the aftercare space is when someone is giving funding, you want to know that that funding is doing what it says it will do.
Great point.
And you want to have somebody overseeing that. And so an organization is liable of sending funding to a place when there's no oversight over that funding. Because, for example, if you're funding a home where abuse or something is happening, and that home normally wouldn't be in existence or would shut down without your funding, mm-hmm. you know, you are liable for that. And so when we were kind of talking about some of the holes, like, you want to make sure that you understand the framework as both from a clinical aspect, but also a business aspect, but also that you're making sure that due diligence is being done.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, I did not work in aftercare. I don't work now. I do, obviously, but that wasn't my lane, but I knew enough to know that that's really critical and important.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's incredibly important to do your due diligence for the people that are giving. Sometimes they're widows' mite, you know, to the cause. You want to make sure that you're honoring the sacrifices that they have, that they're giving. And sustainability, like she mentioned, is a huge part as well. Like a lot of organizations start and fail, right? I think most organizations, nonprofits, fail in the first 3 years of being in existence. And so you want to make sure, again, you're doing your due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing with aftercare, what we wanted was to provide a system where when we do the vetting of places, is not that we're, you know, the judge and we're like, you're in, you're out. No. What we're doing is...
You can do it that way. It doesn't... Who are we?
Yeah. What we're doing is assessing, help them assess where they are,
mm-hmm.
and give them a roadmap on how they can...
Improve.
Yeah. That's what you want to do.
Helping them implement the best level of care.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And with a roadmap, and like Jenny was saying, with a donor matching, then we can say, because a lot of times what would allow them to move on to better care, if you will, would be access to resources. You know, that's something that is always really, really important. And there needs to be oversight. And for oversight, there needs to be transparency and understanding of what you're measuring.
So I want to go back a little bit, just for those who might listen and not completely understand this space. What, in the most succinct way, because there's a number of problems and number of solutions that you're providing, but in the most succinct way you can, what are the problems right now in this space, and what are the solutions that you guys are offering at Aftercare International?
The problems, I think it is that the fragmentation and there's no benchmark for care. You know, what's good, what's bad. I'm not saying that they're not doing good. What I'm saying is, like, is there a, what's the word? Yes. Is there like a standard? There's no clear standard. Mm-hmm. Everybody's operating as best they can. So that's one of the things. We want to provide some sort of a standard.
Yeah, and because they're, like she was talking about, when you have an organization or when you have organizations that are very fragmented, working in silos, competing after the same donor dollars, oftentimes you're spending funding on creating something that's already been created.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if we can create this alliance or this collaboration network where these organizations can start talking to each other and start working together and sharing best practices and sharing information and tools and resources. Think about the sustainability, because donor dollars can then be put to exactly where it needs to be. It's not like, for example, let's say, throw it out there. They really want to create a volunteer program. Do you know how many volunteer programs have been created? I could write one tonight in my sleep, right? Like, let me give you one, and then you cater it to your organization. We can help tweak it so you don't have to put the funding into that, where then you can provide therapy for a child. Mm-hmm. That's been terrific. Yeah. And so a lot of it is just like, let's work together. What was that quote that Walt said to us, or the nun said to us?
Oh, the nun said, you only fight a network with a network.
Mm-hmm. And
so that's what we're thinking. We're thinking is like, yeah, that's what we're trying to do, is have, like Jenny saying, the code of standards. Is that right?
Yeah.
Like having a code of the standards.
Yeah.
You say what other problem is the funding, for sure. That's a huge one. And having the ability, we're blessed to be living in this U.S. is the most charitable country in the world. Is like, we're here. So it's like, let's implement a system that allows us to channel those funds to places that are needed,
mm-hmm.
provide good oversight, provide good information back on how we're measuring, what is being measured, what is the success, what can we improve, and continue to grow that way, but linking both. So yes, it would be, I think, the code of standards. Access to funding is another one that we're trying. And there's also this
research.
Developing research, for sure, is one of the things we want to do for this space. And I think also, I would say number four is that collegiality. It can get really lonely. It's a very difficult field. It's like, even for the people who are providing services, even for those good souls that open the homes and want to provide and are working and are struggling because they don't know where the money is going to come from. They don't even know if they're doing the right thing. It's a really lonely place. There's not a lot of space for self-care at that moment. You're trying to do your best all the time, not feel alone, have others around you that are there to support you as well, and that might be
uphold you
the same.
Yes. Yeah. And I want to just add, just for, again, for those who don't even understand this world at all, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a lot of organizations out there who are trying to fight human trafficking. It's like one of the most horrendous things that goes on, and a lot of hearts are pulled towards wanting to help. But from my understanding and just my limited knowledge in the space, these kids who are trafficked or women who are trafficked, the aftercare typically isn't there. So maybe they get rescued from these situations, and oftentimes they end up right back in the same situation because there's not a safe space. And the right care in place to be able to reintegrate these individuals back into society, and give them the tools and the therapy and all the things necessary to recover and come out of that situation. And so what you guys are doing after Aftercare International is not only helping you guys have a couple homes yourself, but you want to be the one-stop shop for these other organizations to come and be like, hey, this is the standard of care. This is how these individuals need to be taken care of. And let us help you. Let us help you do that. Is that correct?
Yeah. And not only that, I don't want people to think that we have the standard of care. The reality is it's going to come from all these homes, right? Like the tried and true. We're learning and growing as well. And these homes are bringing so much information and knowledge. And as we work together and as we are gathering information, that's where best practices come from.
We're the conduit. We're not a standard.
You're continually learning and trying to do the research to figure out what is
standard. And we're the conduit. Why? Because the people in Ethiopia know what's better for Ethiopian survivors. People in Argentina will know what's better for Argentine survivors. What we can do is try to help them, try to support them, try to provide different formulas that have worked in other places. If they're struggling with something and they want to think out of the box, or they've hit every door and they don't know how to progress. We want to be that space where if we don't know it, we'll find it.
Yeah.
And really the reality is like she said, we're like, we live in the most charitable country. There's so many loving and giving people all over the world, but we are blessed that we can hopefully through donor matching you know, yeah. find people want to give, but they're reluctant. And so hopefully through donor matching, sometimes in some of these places, they have what it takes. They just don't have the funding.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could help get that funding to places where we can say, we know that your money is going to change lives and do what it says it's going to do in these places, and we're going to make sure to our best ability of that, that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to help them improve. I would summarize it that we want to help however we can be the conduit for the quality of care to be improved, whatever that looks like. We didn't write the formula. I don't think there's any formula that will be written that will morph with time and with each situation. And also, so is the quality and also the quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Like there'll be people that say, I don't want to open a new home. Some people want to open a new home. Some people will be like, I don't want to open a new home. What I want to do is help those that are working really hard, are doing a fantastic job. And I just want to help them double the number of beds of survivors. Because like you said, you know, sometimes they come and they go back. And it could be because there are limited resources. There's, you know, they've been there for a short while and the place is struggling to see how they fund things, etc. So, yeah, the quality and the quantity of care for survivors.
You guys just got back from Colombia?
Ecuador.
Yes, I was in
Colombia before.
Okay.
A week or two.
And where are you guys going next month?
Ukraine, but we're hoping Uganda in general.
Hopefully Uganda and then Ukraine. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, because you guys are using, like, we want to, but you guys are doing it right now.
Yeah.
And let's talk about, but obviously you want to do it. You want to continue to grow.
Yes.
To help more and more.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your home in Costa Rica and kind of like the start of that and how maybe a couple of the stories, because there's amazing stories that have come just from that home.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a little bit about that and how that got started.
So we had a very generous soul who decided to open the first home. He was also with our previous endeavor and came over with Aftercare International. He was one of the first board members when it was open in 2019. And there was a very need. I was working. I went down there for COVID. For a year to work in these homes. I kept on just, I have to be focused. I'm this.
You're from
there. And well, I was born there. I'm not from, I was born only there, but I have family, et cetera. So it's really easy for me to move around there. So I took my whole family down for COVID I was working there with 3-4 homes, different ones, and one specifically with girls and taking the most acute cases that they had that were suicidal, self-harming, had been trafficked, et cetera. Because, in the majority of places that we've encountered is not often that you will have homes that are specifically for survivors. In many countries, they'll have a mixture. You know, if it's a state system where they offer residential services for children, then usually it's they'll mix them up, which becomes a problem sometimes, many times. So I was working at this home and one of the gaps that was explained to me was that this girl staying 18, when they turn 18, they're put outside the door because by law, that's an adult and you cannot have an adult with children who have been abused or trauma, neglect, etc. So I was like, where do they go? They've been in here for 8 years. They don't have contact. They don't have family. They don't have anything. Where do they go? They say, we don't. No, they'll find a boyfriend or they'll find, somebody who's a charitable person that worked in the home and was the lady, the cook, and she has an extra room, so she'll let them take the extra room. But they left the home with, some of them hadn't finished school. They don't have any sort of trade. Yeah, no community. No trade skills. Thank you. Any particular trade skills? They haven't finished school. They don't have family. They can't work. And a lot of them don't have papers because they weren't born there and they're from a different country and the whole naturalization process never happened. So they're out in the street. Within 24 hours, we know what happens to them. I mean, they're in desperation. They can't live anywhere. So we said, that's a huge gap. We need to open a home for girls that turn 18, haven't finished school, don't have family, don't have papers. et cetera. Because some of them might know somebody or had an uncle or whatever. Those have some sort of an avenue, but this ones that I'm describing don't. So we opened the first home for them, and it had a whole program. It was a 1-year program where we, teach them financial education, entrepreneurship. They were taking courses such as programming and pedicure and manicure, or hair or beauty or baking, different things that they could be trained on during those 12 months.
Life skills
and variety. Yeah, life skills, and finish their schooling. In some cases, they had to do online schooling to finish 3 grades in 1 year so that they could actually get their baccalaureate. And so everything was in a program measured, and we measured with assessments, during intake as they come in, where they are. And, one of the key questions that children in this situation are always asked is, do you have any adults that you can trust if something was to happen to you? And I would say that 9 out of 10 say no, sorry. Sorry. Or the second question says, if you had to go to the hospital, would there be somebody who would stay with you the night? Do you have anybody who could stay with you? And they say no. So these are girls that are in a state of loneliness that nobody should be. No one should be. No child should be, ever. So we opened the home. It had room for 6 beds, 7 beds. We have 9. And we, at some point, we had 10. Don't tell anybody, because you're not supposed to. But I'm willing to pick up that battle anytime. So yeah, we've had it all for 2 years now. 2 years has been open. We've had, I think, 17 girls gone through the program. We've got 5 alumni. They live together in a home now. We still keep in touch. They still come and help with the girls that are there. I want to say that the 4 that are out, one is in a technical school because she didn't want to do university, but the other ones are in university. Got scholarships for them. The lady that runs the home is phenomenal. She got scholarships for all of them. So they're all studying. We haven't had, and I was saying, so how do you measure success? The gentleman that funds the home, we were talking about this. I said, how you measure success? Because as a clinician, I work with adolescents here in the U.S. And this is how we measure success. They're living together. They are, none of them consume alcohol or drugs. There's been no suicidality, no self-harm. They are healthy teenagers, as they should be, and happy. They get sad if a boy doesn't talk to them or whatever. That's natural. That's good, So, and they dance. Well, they love K-pop. So yeah, it's been a success story. The amount of girls, we got a wait list of girls, we got a wait list of boys. We would open a home for boys if we could, but it's harder to find donors that want to, which is complicated because you also want that male figure, that they didn't have when they were growing up. They don't have a father. They don't observe that. And then that was the first home. And then the second home we opened to extend because we thought there were some of them that, for different reasons, some have different needs. And so we extended it a little bit. The second home is to extend a couple of months until we can help them and settle and find a place. Or the ones that don't have documentation and can't work and can't go anywhere, we wait until they can get their documents to be legal. And then we also have mothers, single mothers, mothers that were institutionalized at the age of 11 to 17, 16, 17. They had their child. And then when they turn 18, they're left outside the door and the baby stays in the system. So we have now 2, and the third one is coming in this month, the third mother that we have there with the children.
So the mother brings her, she's able to bring her child with her.
She stays together with them. So yeah. They stay together, which is how it should be.
Yeah.
And the reality, too, is like you hear these homes could be opened in any city in any part of the world. Like,
yes.
'Cause it's such a huge need.
Yeah, it's a gap.
And a part of it is because of children growing up in institutions. Like, children shouldn't grow up in institutions. Children belong in families. And so this is something that's probably going to be seen even more because we had a generation through the social work process where these institutions were opened, where kids were put in them. And then now we're realizing that they don't have a community, they don't have connection, they don't have resources. And so there's this gap. And so this is probably going to be an area that is a huge hole in need. And we've seen it in everywhere we've gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking about like 18 and older.
And it could be like in Ukraine where we're going, it's 16.
Yeah.
They're sent out. And so the numbers, oh gosh, the stats are, they're horrifying on kids that are aged out of the system in Ukraine that turn to alcohol and prostitution for survival at 16. I mean, it's like in the 70s and above, like the stats. So this is a huge gap. And so we'll probably see, that's something that we'll see a lot of. And, and there's a huge need there.
Yeah, a huge everywhere.
Everywhere. In America as well.
What are a couple of the wins that you guys have seen? I know you, I loved the nail salon store, and we can share that. And maybe like one other, just one of the wins that you've seen these women or other in other facilities.
I know for me, I think one of the greatest parts about working in this space is seeing how many good men and women are loving these individuals as their own and fighting incredible battles to keep them safe. We're talking putting their lives on the line in some situations.
Yeah.
And some of the success stories is like, it's that they're kids that are living normal, happy, healthy lives, you know, like as any child and teen should, like Monica was saying, the fact that these five girls are living together, like that's, they're at the age where they're, you know, they're living in a dorm together and they're
by choice
and they're living as they should be. And but I just am constantly inspired by a win for me is seeing organizations continue to thrive despite all of the challenges. And there are a lot of challenges to overcome when you're working in nonprofit work, but especially in this space. And they just do so, they're incredible. They're so incredibly brave. And the girls themselves,
they're
incredible.
This home that we were talking about, the one in Ecuador, the first one. So they're funded by the government. 60% funded by the government, local government, and 40% by fundraising, and which is another place where we want to, like Jenny was saying, don't reinvent the wheel on how to get volunteers and mentors, you know, and fundraising plans, all those things. They shouldn't be spending their time doing that. They should be spending time with the care of what they're doing. But this home, so it was 60-40, and the government hasn't paid them in 10 months. How are they surviving? Because of kindness, is a miracle, is God. I mean, call it whatever you want, but this is how they close. And you got these people, they're fighting tooth and nail to keep it open. And the girls there, we were with them. They don't know this. They don't know that probably the people running it are thinking,
what are we?
Can I keep this open tomorrow, one more day? You know, so the people, I think the wins are the people and then the people we encounter, like you say, and also the when you see them, like the girls you were talking about, the nail salon in Costa Rica, how that came about. They were like, well, how can we help? You know, they're worried about helping. And so they decided, they grabbed this table, which was destroyed, but they decided to pull the nail salon. So they put the table and they put a chair, and then they had all obtained, they were all gifted some nail polish and stuff to start their own little manicure and pedicure when they took their course. So they all pitched it in and they all put it in this
display.
Thank you. In this whole display. And then I had taken a couple of suitcases of clothes, you know, from my kids and friends. And so they open a store, an online store, and they hang all the clothes. They clean all the clothes. And so you go in and there's one table with one chair to get your nails. And so that's the nail salon. And they are promoting it on Instagram so that they can help the home. It's not for them. It's so they can help the home.
Yeah.
I love them.
That's amazing.
Those are good.
Yeah. I think like the biggest thing for me is just, especially when we're in these homes and the kids are happy.
Yeah.
And they're not always happy. This is a hard road. Like, I think that we sometimes falsify the journey that they're not always happy to see you. They like, it's a tough, long road to healing.
Sometimes they're angry. Sometimes
as they
leave, go back to the trafficker. We have a case, you know, it was a mom and she went back. And a month later, she called us to see if she could please come back. Of course, we took her, but it's like, sometimes it's hard. It's hard because she was with us for a long time. And then she was halfway through the program and left. And all we could say was, you know, the door's open. If the bed is available, the door's open. That's when we put the 10th bed, actually, now that I have to say it. Because the bed wasn't available.
The bed wasn't available, but you made one.
Well, it was, but yeah. But yeah, those stories. And the last one would be like Kathy and Alan, some of the people that run the home. The other day they called me and they said, one of our alumni, this boy invited her out. And so she said that she couldn't go out unless Kathy and Alan, who she considers her parents, because she's never had parents. She was institutionalized since she was like 10, needed to make sure that they approved of him. So, and this is after she's been out, you know, and it's like the love continues to tie them. So it's not, when it's not only about treatment, but it's about, you know, they're a family now.
Yeah.
That's a success. Like, that's a win.
It's like they say, relationships, it's people who harm people and it's relationships that heal people. And
yeah, 100%.
Okay. Just to end, what's your vision for the future of Aftercare International, and also how can people get involved?
Bring all of our best friends to work with us.
No, to have to get funding so that we can reach every country, so that we can reach every country and create this platform where they're all connected, where we can provide them with roadmaps on anything they need. Whether it's serving more people or different services or whatever they want to do, that we can say, here's a repository of information.
Here's how you can elevate what you're doing.
Elevate what you're doing. Also, to improve the field, we want to be able to allow, this field is very new. There's no studies that are, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, longitudinal studies. And we could better serve them.
And when you say the field, like, this has been around forever, but it's a fairly new field as far as...
accepted. Yeah, as acceptance of what it is. You know, the protocol, the Palermo Protocol is 2000, and then the countries start adopting it. And anything that you go through researches, the research that there is gives you a snapshot of what's happening. We haven't gotten to the point where research says...
Sorry, not a Snapchat. A snapshot.
They send a snapshot.
Yeah.
They give you a snapshot. I told you I was going to do that. They give you a snapshot of what is happening, but they don't provide information on how to increase what we're saying, increase that level of care. We're not the experts, but there's people who can do research and provide really good information, and it's not there yet, but we want to be able to provide a field where they can also obtain that information and help
continuing to just, like you said, reach so many homes, because the problem is there. And it sometimes feels overwhelming, but you have to just remember the individual, like, limit it to, like, if you could provide a loving, supportive place where this person could heal, that one individual could heal, it just continuing to increase that number. Mm-hmm. and help organizations that are doing incredible work continue to do the incredible work that they're doing.
Help them.
That would be our long-term goal, is to quantity and quality, like we were saying at the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you guys.
Oh, we didn't say involved. Do you want us to?
Yeah. How can someone get involved?
Yeah. Yeah. So they could reach out to info@aftercareinternational.org, or they could go online. We do have a volunteer application that they could fill out, that we would then get back to them. At this point, our arms are wide open to any support and help, and we're really good at putting people to work.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, well, thank you guys so much for your time, and hopefully we can get this message out to more and more people, because I truly think, like, the work that you guys are doing is life-changing, world-changing work that's needed. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.